You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hello and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent Senior Editor, and I'm here with...
Dee Tran, Associate Editor.
And Susie Evans, I'm the Managing Editor.
And we're here to talk about exciting times this week. We have our May-June issue is hitting newsstands and mailboxes, and a lot of the stories are online as well. It's our annual global issue, international issue, I guess. Means the same thing. This year we focused on Latin American theater. I think we spoke about this a little bit last time on our last podcast. I can't recall. But we have great stories about the opening up in Cuba and what that might mean for theater there, a report from the Santiago Amil Festival in Chile, and also a wonderful piece by one of our former interns, Georgina Escobar, about U.S.-Mexico collaborations between companies on either side of the border. Fascinating stuff. I'm also really, really – this is almost a global piece. Rajiv Joseph wrote a play about the Taj Mahal, about guards at the Taj, and took his actors to India, funded by a Cherry Lane producer. It's a great story. And there's also one I'm really fond of about a Saints tour in Pittsburgh. So those you can read those online. That's Molly Rice's Saints tour. Read those online. Are there any other stories in this issue you wanted to shout out or call out?
I don't know. We should call out the Guards of the Taj is opening in Atlantic.
That's at the Atlantic Theater, yes, in
and
May.
Then it also has two other productions
Three.
Coming up. Three.
Three other productions announced. Woolly Mammoth, Geffen, and what's the other one?
La Jolla.
La Jolla.
So all over the U.S. you can check out Guards of the Taj, but you heard it at American Theater first.
But there's actually P.J. Paparelli's at the American Theater, his docu-theater piece about Chicago housing.
I'm just
looking through my table of contents
theater
here.
Company.
American Theater Company. Yeah, often mistagged with us with yes. American Theater because they spell it American. Their Twitter handle is just American Theater ER. Ours is just American Theater RE.
Luckily, we like each other.
So that's interesting. Oh, yeah, and the 24th Street Theater. That's a great segue to my other topic. 24th Street Theater is a wonderful little 99th theater in L.A. And I had a story this week online where I spoke to the Equity's executive director about what Equity is up to in Los Angeles, and as many feared and predicted, they went ahead and Equity went ahead and promulgated a series of proposals. Get into the details of it, but essentially, many feel that they did not listen to the referendum vote of their members. Other people say, well, they, in a sense, they did. There are still many opportunities for actors to volunteer their services, just under different terms. Of course, there's a huge LA theater scene, which is very used to the terms they've been doing for 30 years. So it's a debate that's ongoing. I had another conversation with a pro 99 person today, which will get up online at some point. So it's not going away. Equity is scheduling meetings in June with folks, and there's some counter proposals about to come out from the pro 99 side. So we'll stay on that story. I have a particular rooting interest because I lived in LA for a long time. I'm need to keep my focus on the national scene, but we're keeping the focus on this story as well because it has implications for the whole country and the issue of artist compensation. So in New York theater, I don't know, not much news to report. There's the Pulitzer went to Stephen Edgar's
Riverside and Crazy.
Between Riverside and Crazy.
Yes, indeed.
Which premiered at Atlantic Theater Company over the summer and then had the same production re-put up by Second Stage Theater, both in New York. Really great play about kind of a little bit, I think, autobiographical for Stephen, although I don't think he'll admit it. It takes place in a big rent-controlled apartment on Riverside Drive where an older gentleman has lived there forever, and he kind of has these friends who have become family who live with him for free. And Stephen Ali Gurgis actually lives in a big rent-controlled apartment on Riverside Drive that his parents got where he has friends who are family who live with him for free. So.
Right. He's also a former cop, right? No, just kidding.
He's not a former cop. But actually, when they were doing the play at Atlantic, Stephen told me this when I interviewed him. We have an interview with him on American Theater.
Yeah.
When he won the Steinberg Award, he told me that Stephen McKinley Henderson, who plays the cop in the play, the main actor, he stayed with Stephen Adler Gurgis when they were doing Atlantic to save Atlantic money on housing, and it helped with, you know, working on the play.
Wow.
He actually lived in that house, so.
It's close to home, literally.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's autobiographical in the storyline, but it is interesting that there is that parallel between their lives.
Cool.
Great play.
So are there any other awards to talk about in New York?
Yeah, this well, you know, kind of thing called
this
Tonys.
Is a little thing called the Antoinette Perry Awards, otherwise known as the Tony Awards, yes, which were yes. announced on Tuesday, April 28th.
Yeah. Nominations, not the actual Tony
nominations,
Awards.
Yes. The awards will be announced on June 7th from Radio City Music Hall. Rob is rolling his eyes right now.
I'm against award shows on principle, but except when I stage them. I Backstage West used to do awards, and I before that and after that we did those, I held fast to a award suck policy. But you know, I think they highlight valuable artists and people. I'm not against that. I just don't like the competitive nature. Then the amount of, I'll just give you my quick reason why I don't like awards. I feel like the amount of ink spilled and serious, like, critical thought that goes into, like, who deserves it and who doesn't deserve it. I can't take it seriously. Like, nobody deserves anything. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, you can't compare Fun Home and Something Rotten. They're not even this, in this, you know, as something to write about and cover. They keep us busy for a while. So what do we have to say?
Well, I do think that Rob wrote a piece on the morning of nominations that was interesting, and it's something that we point to about Broadway. I think Gordon Cox did a big feature about it a year or so ago about all the shows that started a nonprofit that come to Broadway. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the biggest front runners this year are Fun Home, which started at the Public, Hand to God, which started at Ensemble Studio Theater and then moved to MCC Theater, both nonprofits and, here, there's also some British nonprofits that have theaters, you know, Wolf Hall and Skylight and...
Actually, Skylight was commercial,
Skylight was
as far
not,
as I know. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, Wolf Hall and Curious Incident both came from the National Theater.
Yeah,
and
no,
the
RLC and National.
Company.
Yeah, exactly. And even, this is probably not a first, American in Paris started at a French nonprofit.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I know, Theatre Châtelet is a nonprofit. I mean, or
it's state-supported.
I don't know if they have the same terminology.
I talked with the producers a little bit, and they talked about how it was a nonprofit there, and the American in Paris producers wanted to do a tryout at a nonprofit, and they were thinking about doing one in the U.S., and it turned out that one of the producers, I forget which one, had a relationship with the artistic director at the theater in France, and they didn't know it, and he was expressing interest in the topic, and they randomly connected like 10 years later.
Wow.
And we're like, you're a nonprofit tryout, you just happen to be in Paris.
Wow, great.
Which is interesting, because the goal at a nonprofit tryout is to test audience feedback on material and rewrite around that. When you have a French audience with an English language show, it's a little bit harder to test the feedback.
Yeah, so what's well, reminds me of the story. Lynn Aaron's talking about trying out Rocky in German. It's like, I asked her, how do you know? It's like, you can tell when people are into it or not. It's like, okay.
But see, Rocky, they translated to German. American in Paris, they kept the name.
I know, yeah. But, yeah.
It's so odd, though, because European audiences have like a completely different relationship to theater than American audiences
do you mean?
Just because, like, I feel like...
Were they sit sideways or something?
No, because no, relationship no, to theater insofar as it's more part of the culture there. Like in London, and in Europe, where it's state-supported, like, it's... This is seen as a valid, you know, common form of entertainment.
Right.
And here...
It's different.
It's different. Yeah. It's true. But it's really different in Paris in the extent that musical theater is not a common art form for them.
Yeah,
not a mass-produced art form. They very rarely get American-style musical theater. And so they're reacting to the show both as a new art form and as an English language show.
Yeah, I would almost think that French would love... French audiences, this is a total stereotype about them loving American pop culture, but I think they do love American pop culture, and if it's done in a certain way, and you know, you would almost think that gauging an audience reaction by that would be over, like pretty inflated of how much they love it.
I have a funny story about the French loving American pop culture. When I was 11, I was an exchange student in France.
Yeah.
And the two girls that I lived with, I spent the entire trip there teaching them the Macarena and the lyrics to all the Spice Girls songs.
Well, yes. And Jerry Lewis, of course, is a king there. But in any case, American in Paris has done very well here. I mostly liked it. I still think that the revival to beat for pretty much all time is on the town, but the two of them are great.
King and I.
Yeah, I don't
another
like that
nonprofit,
very much.
Lincoln Center.
Yeah, did you like King and I?
I did.
I was really disappointed, I gotta say.
Really?
Can I say that?
You're allowed to say it. Yeah.
I feel like Kelly O'Hara is so perfect for the role. I felt that going in and coming out, I felt like she just didn't add that much to it. And I found Ken pretty weak in many ways.
Oh, I thought his acting was amazing. I was talking with Bart Sherry yesterday about it, and he was talking a lot about how the nuances of the American language are so different than Ken's native language, I think is Japanese, yeah. right? And so finding the nuances and the comic timing in that part in an English language as a Japanese actor is such an interesting challenge.
I felt the effort. I would say that his physicality was amazing. But I would say the version I saw 20 years ago with Donna Murphy and Lou Diamond Phillips, believe it or not, was Australian production, was great. And I, there's something about Donna Murphy, the she's against type for the role, but the gravity and sort of backbone she brought to that role was really helpful. I feel like the role is kind of sweet and kind of sentimentally written, and that Kelly O'Hara just sort of plays into that. But that's just my...
Well, I do want to add that this is Kelly O'Hara's sixth Tony nomination to no
avail.
She still
doesn't want... Yeah,
she should get one. It is her time.
I wouldn't disagree. She should get one at some point. Of course, no one should get anything, but that's my... but go on.
But some other fun, like we were talking about Hand to God, which is the EST, the two lead actors in that, which the roles were essentially written for, Robert Askins, the playwright... essentially wrote the two main roles for Geneva Carr and Stephen Boyer, two yeah. fairly unknown actors at this point. I think Stephen's been on Broadway. He did King Lear with John Lithgow in the Park with the Public this summer. But they both got nominations. I mean, Geneva Carr's in a category with Helen Mirren, Carey Mulligan, Elizabeth Moss, and Ruth Wilson, all huge Hollywood stars.
And yeah, so, I can get excited about their possibility if they win.
The underdog awesome. Possibility.
But they yeah. are playing these roles that they've been playing since the Black Box Theater to Broadway that were essentially crafted for their strengths, which is, you know, a very interesting and rare thing to see on Broadway.
But Tyrone didn't get his own nomination.
I did hear that Tyrone sent Helen Mirren flowers and she sent him a thank you note back. And Geneva goes, I don't think she knows who he is.
For those of us who have not seen Hand of God, Tyrone is the demonic sock puppet.
Yeah, yeah. Was it a tasteful thing?
I think she just sent like a very nice thank you, probably some sort of stock thank you. She gets a lot of flowers, but she did send Tyrone a thank you. some other exciting.
Isn't Tyrone? They're going to host the.
What are drama
gonna,
desk?
Yeah,
they're gonna, yeah. Well, one of yeah. the they are.
Stephen Boyer and Tyrone league. Are going to host.
One of the drama league. Laura Benanti's doing drama desk. Another fun fact is if Janine Tesori and Lisa Crone win, the Fun Home wins Best Musical, it will be the first ever Best Musical to win that's written by all women. Ever.
Which might equalize the lack of women playwrights that's on Broadway usually and this season as
yeah,
well.
Neither the Heidi Chronicles by Wendy Wasserstein received a Best Revival nomination, and Lisa D'Amore's Airline Highway,
which
started at Steppenwolf and moved to Manhattan Theater Club, didn't receive a nomination. Those were the only two plays by women on Broadway, other than if we count Wolf Hall with Hilary Mantel's book. And she did receive a nomination because the Tony Administration Committee ruled that she was considered a co-author of the play, even though she authored the book.
Who adapted it? Was it somebody?
Oh, I forget what his name is.
Some dude, some British dude.
But it's. I think that's rare, too, to have the actual book author be considered a co-author for a play when, in fact, she didn't write the play.
I will say, overall, I'm going to write up something about the musicals this season. I would say that I'm generally... It's been a good season for musicals. I think, at least in the last couple of weeks, I feel like the revivals are you know, King and I is not a terrible show. It's a really solid revival. And American in Paris and Gigi are kind of revivals in a sense. They're not really revivals. They're not that qualified as that. But
Gigi is qualified as a revival.
Yeah, that one is. But those both feel like old style shows. And then new shows. I mean, I saw Fun Home and Something Rotten within one, like night back to back. And you know, you couldn't have a better. Even though I think it's ridiculous that they could compete with each other, I'll just say that you couldn't have a better demonstration of how the musical is in great shape. The new American musical. You have one totally serious form breaking musical and one that's just, you know, one of the best like entertaining, just indefensibly silly. In the sort of mold of the producers or Spamalot kind of shows, and I think it's great that they're both there.
But then we go back to the year when Billy Elliot versus Next to Normal were running for Best Musical, which were both very different. And Next to Normal took Score, but Billy Elliot took Best Musical. And I still remember Sir Elton John saying from the platform, "Like, keep writing Next to Normal, guys." He was essentially saying, "Like, this new American musical that you've written has just been beaten by this big British juggernaut."
Right, right, right.
And then the year we had Kinky Boots versus Matilda, both American musicals. Kinky Boots won, both because they were both good shows that people liked, but Kinky Boots was the American one, and I think people felt the backlash.
You think that there's a rooting interest there?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. Yeah.
Felt the backlash of Billy Elliot beating out.
Unfortunately, they kept
musical.
Writing about If Then, but we won't talk about that.
Well, they did win the Pulitzer for Next to Normal.
They did. That was a consolation prize.
Yeah.
Well, is a Pulitzer like a better indication of what is American theater?
Well, given that it's only given to
they Americans. Rarely are given to musicals. There's, I think there's only
that's yeah. true.
There's only eight that have won.
That's true.
It's Rent.
I am going to go way out on a limb here and say that Hamilton is a
oh yeah, it's going to get odds-on favorite. That's not on year. A limb. Everyone agrees. Okay. It's getting the Pulitzer next year.
All right.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Unless, who knows? You know, Sondheim could write his David Ives piece could come out like and blow everyone away.
Or there could be a good play because, you know, the Pulitzer Committee loves a good play.
They do love good plays. Yeah, it's possible there could be a good play between now and then.
It's got to be somewhere between now in America, and December.
A good play will be produced.
Well, The Humans was really well received. Stephen
that's
Graham's
true. The
play.
Humans. I'm looking forward to that very much.
And so that's coming out this year. Although I think, is it out roundabout this year or next year?
I think it's this season, this fall.
And Josh Harmon, who had Bad Juice, which was a favorite, has a new play opening next month. So there's, you know, good plays coming up.
There's always good plays coming up. They just don't get nominated for Tonys because they aren't on Broadway. Because but we're there's talking. No one financing
yes,
experimental,
yes.
important
well,
plays.
Well,
hand to God.
That's like the... That's a, Hand of God and Airline Highway. That's like two out of star out of things that contain star platforms containing people who written by people who have been dead for 20 years.
But I mean, Airline Highway is an exception where it's actually at two nonprofits. Hand of God went from nonprofit to nonprofit to full on commercial run. Airline Highway is still at a nonprofit on Broadway.
Yeah, I that's the other reason the Tonys seem a little silly to me, because the Oscars at least include independent films, but obviously the Tonys. Are, as some have put it, they're a real estate promotion. I mean, they are for not just for a size of theater, but for like a particular theater district, and then one that bought their way into it because they're, you know, uptown. But in any case,
and they were fine, and they could find people who could finance.
Well, of course,
$2 million
the bar for the Tonys is high. I mean, I do think it again. It's a giant spotlight on new theater. And also, people who talk about Broadway as just being the Disneyland. Broadway has problems with diversity, definitely, of aesthetic diversity and ethnic diversity. But
And gender diversity.
But Broadway is not – I just – when people say it's a wasteland or that it's all Disney and tourists, I just don't – I don't see that reflected in the plays. I think they're good, solid plays. It's whether they reflect all of America or meet a lot of those other criteria. That's debatable.
I mean, we forget that Disgrace was on Broadway this season, which was at Lincoln Center and won the Pulitzer Prize for Ayad Akhtar.
Right. Well, great. I think that's about as much Tony talk as I can stomach for any one year. No, we'll talk more about it.
We will talk more about it because Susie could keep talking about it.
Yes, she could.
And the actual awards show needs to come up, and we need to talk about that when that happens.
I guess we do. In any case, speaking of Susie talking, you went to Chicago recently and spoke to...
Yeah, I went to Chicago last weekend and saw some shows, and I saw one of the shows I saw was Will Eno's Title Indeed at Looking Glass Theater Company, which is a one-man show, and the actor Michael Patrick Thornton, who Mass America might know from the TV show Private Practice, but is really a born and bred Chicago actor. He's the co-artistic director of a storefront theater there called The Gift. He's done a lot of work with Will Eno. I think this is his fourth. They're really strong collaborators, and they've been trying to get this play off the ground for a long time, this one-man show. He really wanted to do it. It's kind of a hard show to do, and Looking Glass seems like an unlikely theater to do it in, because Looking Glass's
mission
is kind of physical theater adaptations from literary works. And so they ended up being the theater that I ended up working with. And so I sat down with Michael while I was out there and talked a little bit about the show and about his collaboration with Eno and his work in Chicago and being such a dedicated Chicago actor. And another thing that we talked about that I think is really interesting that I don't think gets covered enough in the media is Michael is actually a wheelchair-bound actor, and something that happened a little bit later in life after he graduated from school. And so it definitely adds a layer thematically to the play itself, which is kind of about existence and life, which is really interesting. There's some lines in the play that call out to it. The character's just called The Traveler. And Michael works steadily in Chicago, does a lot of great work, and just talked about kind of the issues that, you know, actors with different abilities face, and it's a really enlivening conversation, I think, so I hope you enjoy it.
Let's turn it over to that. We'll be back at the end for some recommendations.
Yeah, this is Susie Evans. I'm here in Chicago with Michael Patrick Thornton, who's starring in Title Indeed at Looking Glass Theater Company. Very exciting.
Yes.
You got a three named actor thing going on, Michael.
I guess so, yeah. It works for assassins and actors. When I joined Equity, Mike Thornton was already taken. Yeah. So I had to do the triptych.
The triptych. Does anyone ever call you MPT?
Yeah, that's pretty pervasive, actually.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of people in Chicago call me that.
That's amazing.
To my embarrassment and small delight. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I kind of asked that as a joke, but I guess, can no. I call you MPT?
Of course you can. This saves a lot of time.
Oh, my gosh. Cool. Well, I saw the play yesterday, and I really loved it. It's such a moving, kind of poetic piece of work, and kind of a non-traditional piece for Looking Glass to do.
Totally.
Stuff is movement-based and based on literary works. How did you kind of get connected to the show?
Well, you know, Will, you know, the playwright is a friend of mine, and this is our fourth collaboration now. We did Middletown together at Steppenwolf, and then we did this. I directed Will's Ode to Humanity at my theater company, The Gift, and the director, Marty Lyons, of this play was my assistant on that play. And then Will wrote a world premiere 10-minute play for The Gift as well. So we just were in contact, and I said, you know, I had known that this guy, Connor, had done this one-person show that Will had written. I said, can I read it? And I think for a good 8 months, I was just kind of reading it aloud on a semi-weekly basis just in my condo, you know. And then I said, I think I really want to do this, you know. And he said, I think that'd be great. We both agreed that my theater, The Gift, wasn't the ideal venue. It's very small. It's about 40 seats. And you kind of wanted a regal space to dwarf the guy a bit. And I said, look, there's this up-and-coming director, and I think she's great. And I don't want to see her fall through the cracks. And I would really like it if we could just kind of make a pact that you'll stick up for me, and that's kind of the deal in terms of who plays it, and then we stick up for Marty, and that's the deal for who directs it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And so we shopped it around a little bit, and Looking Glass, you know, Marty's the literary manager here, and they asked, we were downstairs actually at The Wheel with Joan Allen at Steppenwolf, and I had a little bit too much champagne, and Phil Smith was there. And we were talking about just what it's like to run theater companies and their challenges and my challenges at The Gift. And he said, so what are you working on these days? And I said, hey, there's this play by Will Eno, you know. And they were like, well, we'll send it to us. And I said, no, because I said, you're going to steal it. You're going to try to get one of your people to play it and direct it. And, you know, it's going to be a mess. So, no. And it was a friendly kind of fucking with each other, you know, and down in the basement of Steppenwolf over champagne. And then I really didn't send it to him. Like, they were emailing and then going up to Marty's desk and being like, no, seriously, we want to read this. And so, I don't know, I just playfully kind of hard to get at it for a while, you know. And then Marty sent it to them. They loved it. They brought me in to come do a read for their staff and their ensemble via Skype. And, you know, my expectations weren't too optimistic that they would do it. I mean, it doesn't feature an ensemble member. It's a one-person show. It's not directed by an ensemble member. And I run an ensemble theater, so I get it, you know. But in a way, maybe that freed me up to not worry about the consequences. And we read it, and I guess they loved it, and here we are.
Wow. Had you worked at Looking Glass before?
I've never worked at Looking Glass. I took a viewpoints class through Looking Glass. Oh boy, like when I first dropped out of college, like 2000 or something like that.
But
No, and then after I got sick, I don't know if you're going to have a picture of me in the wheelchair on the podcasting, but I use a wheelchair. You know, there was a pang of sadness, I remember, as you kind of run through your head the venues that you never worked at that you wanted to, and Looking Glass was at the top of that, you know, like, because I just thought, you know, we don't really see sometimes people who are otherwise ably, you know, able-bodied, as kind of, you know, doing the kind of large physical theater that and spectacle that Looking Glass has made a name on. And I thought, well, there's a theater I'll probably never work at, you know? And so it's kind of amazing to be here in this, oddly physical and oddly spectacle piece, but in more of the mind or something.
Totally. I was actually going to bring that up because I don't know if we will have a picture either. And I think that it adds such an interesting layer to the piece because there is a moment of the play where he talks about ability and access in the play itself, isn't there?
A little bit, yeah. He says, I don't know how I see myself, honestly. Maybe slightly taller with different insides, a little more mobile. And he does, and there's a lot of talk about the body and how we view the body. You know, I just finished David Rabe's The Primitive Heart, which is his collection of short stories, and that's a real big motif in that book of this alienation from your body, and that the body has its own kind of wants and impulses and drives, and we're kind of like a passenger in a plane, right? And the pilot is us as well. Mm-hmm. And that can be very kind of unmooring and unhoming, you know, in terms of where do you locate yourself? Like, who's the you? And I think there's a bit of an existential tailspin that this guy's going through too, of like, I know I'm not my body. I feel beyond the borders of my skeleton, but then what's that thing? You know, what is this thing called identity in life, and where do I belong? You know?
Yeah.
You know, I think it presents itself first as a where play, you know, should I stay or should I go?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think just by virtue of kind of being out there and doing the show and tell and enduring the time, it ends up turning into a bit of a who play, you know, of who am I? And am I a person good enough to even be a citizen of anywhere?
Yeah.
You know, will anyone take me?
Yeah. I mean, there's that beautiful quote from Will, you know, the playwright in the playbill for the show, where he talks about his 6-month-old daughter and seeing her, like, you know, have experienced bodily functions for the first time and then smile and laugh. And he's like, the body is always a body, but the mind is always a mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of the separation of the two, which I think is at the crux of this play.
Yeah, right. There's that talk about triangulation too, you know, two distant points so as to triangulate a third and more vivid possibility of, like, you know, who you were, who you are, and then who you kind of want to be. But yeah, there's a certain existential fracturing that's happening. You know, and an effort to kind of put the pieces back together.
Yeah. We should probably talk a little bit about what the play is about, if we can talk.
Sure.
It's a little existential. It's a one-man show.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you on stage. You play a guy called the Traveler.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, it's kind of an existential meditation on life and existence and belonging.
Yeah, he comes out with his bag and his stick and his lunchbox. He comes to talk to the audience to say, this is where I'm from. I've been in your country or on your planet for this amount of time. Here are the things that I've noticed that strike me as different. And I'm trying to make up my mind of whether I should go back home or stay here. And then by virtue of simply staying out there with them and talking to them, it gets into much deeper things of the heartbreak he's had and the parents that he's lost. I think it's a poetic portrait of loneliness, you know, an extremely empathetic, humanistic portrait of loneliness and the human condition, which, you know, as alien as he seems, and he'll talk about places in his country when the frogs begin to thaw or something like that. So there's these lines that you can identify him as something as the other. But in an odd way, it almost seems like by the end of the play, the things we do as human beings almost seem to be the alien stuff.
Okay.
You know, not grieving properly the passing of our loved ones, or keeping quiet the internal odd thoughts that we have sometimes, you know. So it's a very hopefully beguilingly strange and welcoming and hopefully somehow redemptive experience. You know, it seems like an anti-monologue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, monologue is like, I know what I want, I'm going to go out there, these are my tactics by which I'm going to try to procure the thing I want. And he's just like, I'm feeling this thing that I don't like feeling, and I'm going to go out there and kind of talk to you for a bit and then see what happens, you know. So it seems like the flip of what we usually think of.
Yeah. How did you meet Will? How did you guys become friends?
Will and I met on Middletown as Steppenwolf.
Awesome.
And to my knowledge, I got cast in that because he liked the sound of my voice. I hate the sound of my voice.
That's in the play, that he hates the sound of his voice.
Yeah, I don't know if my voice sounds funny, or I have a sad way of talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I feel like I'm being expressive and kind of interesting when I do like these radio interviews, and then I go back and hear it, and I'm like, oh my God, I sound like Ferris Bueller's teacher or something like that, you know. So I'll take your laughter as
a sure, totally. I don't think you would sound like Ferris Bueller's teacher.
A soporific voice, a soothing voice.
It is very soothing.
Perhaps not what you want in the theater when you're doing an hour and 5 minute monologue, but.
Yeah. And so then you just bonded from that, from Middletown.
We did, yeah. I mean, that was, again, that was an exquisitely difficult role and play to pull off. And I remember reading Will's stuff a long, long time ago. I think maybe just after I left school or something. And, you know, Will and kind of the obsessive kind of description sometimes of David Foster Wallace or something, but were kind of two writers I remember just feeling so comforted when I read them, of like, they're out in the world. And I felt these things. My head feels like this, or my heart feels like this. And like Radiohead, thank God that someone expressed that panic in that way. And they've kind of used it as an engine for good, as opposed to, you know, inwardness and darkness, you know. And,
yeah. And
then to get to actually then work on the play with Will in the room as Steppenwolf, and then for him to become a friend and then an advocate, it's an incredible trajectory.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so much of his plays are about language, and he writes with such a rhythmic pattern, and I feel like the sound of someone's voice or speech patterns are really important to delivering his plays.
I would think so. I would think so, yeah.
Yeah. How do you kind of memorize that or prepare? What was kind of the process as you put together this hour and 5 minute monologue?
Well, I think this is definitely the hardest thing I've ever done because, any kind of adjustments can send the thing into a different orbit that you may not want. So it's like with Will's stuff, it seems like it's a very tiny slipstream you have to kind of get into of being relatable and conversational and underplaying a bit as the actor, but not so much that it comes off as glib. It needs to be important and absolutely vital on a human level, personally, but that can't manifest in something being didactic or like a PowerPoint presentation, because it's not a speech. It's often, it's building the plane in flight as it kind of crashes towards the earth, you know. It needs to be relatable and personable, but yet not so much that it feels like a stand-up show, you know. So it felt very much like a dramaturgical version of the game Operation, you know, where you just one wrong tremble and it was like, wrong, you know. And the real trick of the thing, the trickiness of it seemed to be, in order to have the audience feel that I'm out there kind of making it up on the spot, that this guy is really riffing in kind of a jazz show way off of a large theme that's kind of a question mark of a feeling. Mike the actor, I actually can't be up there with the next line in my back pocket, kind of knowing where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have to be willing to get lost, for real.
Because it seems like that the character gets lost a few times.
Yeah.
It really does.
Right. And in that anti-monologue way, he's kind of like not the most adroit public speaker.
Yeah.
Like in Marty's Wonderful Direction. He doesn't even hit center stage, I think, until 50 minutes into it.
Oh, wow.
You know? And he's perfectly fine to kind of sit there and, like, pick his ear or try to swallow for 30 seconds and simply be in silence with people.
Yeah.
Which I think is... I think Will's, so that was the trick of it, is how do you make something feel extemporaneous that isn't, you know, a kind of snide response would be, it's called acting. But in a play about being lost in a meta way, the person doing it kind of has to be lost too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a beauty of kind of trusting that I will get pulled through the thing somehow by virtue of strangers that I won't meet until I go out there, you know, and it's very, very scary. And I think Will's willingness to write plays or characters who sit in silence for a bit or talk about these very simple but profound, huge things in a kind of a single entendre way that isn't kind of like with hipster disaffectedness or not, you know. I think it's remarkably brave because I think at the end of the day what it does is it increases empathy in the spirit and in the mind and heart of the listener. And I can feel it out there when people turn off and they're like, fuck this. I'm not going on the ride.
Yeah.
I think he has I think Will has his finger on the pulse of kind of the American denial of death. You know, it's the thing we don't like to talk about. You know, we have a whole city on the West Coast devoted to not talking about death, you know.
Yeah.
And an industry springing up around beauty and eternal youth, you know. And I think Will's saying in a very simple and gentle way, man, life is short and it's really, really, really hard sometimes. But isn't it beautiful, too? I hope you pay attention, you know?
Yeah.
And that rattles the shit out of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm consistently stunned how divisive his work can be.
Totally.
And he's not writing about, I mean, I guess he's writing about the biggest hot topic issue, but just the one that we don't include in any of those lists, which is life and death.
Yeah. But I feel like he's doing it in such a poetic, and it is outright, but it's outright in a poetic, non-linear, totally, like, he's not like he's an activist. It's not like he's saying, you're going to die.
Right.
He's saying, you should cherish the moment.
Yes, I think he's, what was a quote they always attached to Vonnegut, like a laughing prophet of doom or something, you know? Yes. I think there's a gentle kind of court jester nature, you know, but also, yeah, I mean, there's the poetry to Will stuff, and there's no finger wagging, no. I don't think so at all.
Another thing that's interesting, you mentioned the audience, and there are a lot of moments in the piece where you directly address the audience. Sure. I mean, there's not audience participation, as you would say, but...
Sometimes.
Do people talk back sometimes?
Yeah, yeah. What's that stuff you serve on salad here? And dressing? Croutons? One guy broke my heart last night, you know, I think it was the night show, when I said, there's a nice little glow here, though. Is that, am I seeing that right? Sort of morning-like, late morning? And this guy in the front row to my right was like, yeah. He was like, yeah, man. You know, and it just seemed like he was there for me, you know. And in a very, very real way, it is profoundly lonely on that stage, you know. And I actually do need these people to make it. I mean, I can just flip a switch and do the monologue. But that's not what it's about, and that's not really what Marty and Will are asking of me, and of you and the audience, you know. I mean, he says we came here to get somewhere. And so in a very real way, you know, there's no such thing as a one-person show, really, especially not a Willino show. It's a 200-person show.
Yeah. You know? You've done some solo performance before this, haven't you?
I did. I did Connor McPherson's The Good Thief in 2006. And then I did Will Nedved, the co-founder of My Theater, The Gift. I did a 10-minute play of his at The Gift for their 10-minute play festival.
Yeah.
So it was a nice warm-up to get back into it.
Yeah. Do you enjoy it?
I do. I'm an only child, so I'm okay, you know, on my own a bit. But I enjoy the specificity of it. I enjoy kind of the research part of it, of making sure you have the images in your mind properly and all these people cast and... and I enjoy the level of listening you have to be at to kind of change a little bit on a dime, depending on a noise going off for someone's Siri going off.
That happened at the performance I was at, right before you started. I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Yeah. That was the evening show, is that right?
Afternoon
show, right. Was I forget, they're all kind of blending together, if that was the quiet one or the loud show, I forget. Mm-hmm. One person's Siri went off, and I was talking about, I forget which part of the script, and her Siri said, I'm sorry, Elizabeth, I can't help you with that. And it just seemed so perfectly, like, you know, ask, just like, kind of on your own with that question, Elizabeth, but best of luck to you.
Watch the show.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. I love that you have the Gift Theater. That's a storefront theater in
it
the
is,
city,
yeah.
right? That's a big senior in Chicago, storefront theater, ensemble-based theater.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you love about being a part of that community here?
Well, the Gift, you know, we're turning 15 years old next year. I think we're Chicago's smallest equity theater.
Oh, wow.
It's about 40 seats. Storefronts are usually non-equity because it's just a financial game of hell, you know, to make it work, really.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, and I like the intimacy of it. I like, you know, something that Will's interested in, too, of let's not immediately leapfrog the first thing we know about theater, which is it's live, and there are actual human beings coming to actually sit in the dark and, for the most part, behave, you know? And that's kind of, there's a quiet heroism to that, you know? And he's celebrated that in many of his works, you know? And I think the Gift is interested in that up-close magic. And this is not a movie theater. This is, we're 3 feet away from you, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you get a different quality of acting when it's that close. You know, it can be more contained, more filmic, or... we just love it. I mean, so we've been in a neighborhood called Jefferson Park since 2005 is when we moved in. And there was really nothing there. It was a cultural wasteland. People laughed at it, you know. And now we have the Chicago Fringe Festival there. We have the Ed Paschke Museum. We have Filament Theater down the street. I mean, it's being called in the Sun-Times the next kind of theater district of Chicago. The businesses around us have boomed because we're bringing thousands of people in. So, I mean, the Gift is a great little... is a great story about that the arts have a huge economic impact, you know, and it's in the neighborhood I grew up in because I grew up as this kind of weird kid writing plays and novels in my basement when other people were to baseball practice, and I watched everyone that I loved and wanted to be move away, and I just thought, after we kind of did a couple plays when the Gift first started, that this is kind of stupid. We're in the same neighborhood as everyone else. We're renting out spaces whenever they come available and then figuring out the play after that. What are we really changing here? So what if we can do a play and it gets a great review or some nonsense award, you know? Why don't we actually change the way that theater's consumed?
Mm-hmm.
And so to have it in a very middle-class city worker kind of neighborhood of cops and firemen, and have them become art supporters. It gets us to a place where perhaps one day we'll be inviolate to kind of what any kind of review says, and we don't need them to sell tickets. And it's a true community,
yeah.
You know, of art supporters. And
yeah, I should say you're co-founder and co-artistic director of the Gift, which is so great. And I mean, I feel like Chicago is a town where an artist or an actor or a writer can come and start something on their own. It's very
mm-hmm.
different than New York or any other city in that way. There's that community here.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people, I teach at the School of Steppenwolf every year, and I was doing a show at the Actors Theater of Louisville, which a bunch of young kids were like, where do I move now? You know, I think this, the talk of what's the best theater town, I mean, there's people doing amazing theater in Louisville, there's people doing amazing theater in Maryland and D.C., but If you want to talk about exactly your point of coming to a theater, coming to a city and being able to work right away, out of the big three, there's no contest. I mean, at any given time, there's about 300 theaters in the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
And you can come here and you can train. You can train at Second City or I.O. or Annoyance or Steppenwolf and all these amazing black box theater. And the community, it very much is a city of a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it's also, the theater community is also very, very tight-knit here. So I think the runway is just a lot shorter here for growth and getting your feet wet and getting on stage fast and not ending up just in oblivion.
Yeah. And you grew up here.
Grew up in Jefferson Park in Chicago. I still live in Jefferson Park.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's so cool. So you just never wanted to leave.
I do. God, of course I did. You know, yeah, I mean, I went to Iowa for 2 years, and then I certainly had those impulses of like, oh, what time to move to LA or New York or something, and then it just never felt right, you know? Just felt selfish.
Yeah. You've done some great work on TV as well, though, too, in addition to theater.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks.
Do you like kind of balancing the two?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I do like balancing the two. I wouldn't mind pivoting over just a little more to TV and film, maybe after this is... This has kind of taken a lot out of me, you know? Yeah, it's a certain kind of exquisite hell, you know, doing this show, that I love it, and I'm so fortunate for it. In many ways, it's really getting me through some stuff in my own life right now with loved ones who are not doing well. But it costs something, you know? And there's something nice about the exquisite pressure of, like, we're going to shoot this scene, and it's done forever, you know?
Yeah.
Something ridiculous. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. I'd always laugh when they would say, cut, that finishes the scene. I'm like, really? That finishes the scene, you know?
Scene is never done on stage.
I know, right, yeah. No, I do miss it. I mean, I've you know, Shonda Rhimes changed my life, you know?
Yeah, you were on Private Practice.
On Private Practice, yeah.
Yeah.
Linda Lowy was the casting director, and Jeff Perry's wife from
Steppenwolf
and Scandal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have those three to thank for that whole part of my life.
Yeah. Seems like you've gotten a lot of really cool opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, that was great. I just finished an independent film called The View from Tall that two remarkable Chicago women did, Erica Weiss and Caitlin Parrish. And Amanda Drinkel is my co-star in that. She's ridiculously good. I mean, the talent pool is just here is astounding. It's pretty hard to turn into an asshole in Chicago because you think of, oh my God, I mean, you can name 10 people, like, what would they do with this role?
Yeah.
I gotta try to be as good or better than all of them, which is ridiculous because it's a qualitative art form, right? But I'm blown away by the talent here.
Yeah, totally. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, and we kind of touched on it at the beginning, was this idea of, you know, use a wheelchair, use a wheelchair on stage, but the character's not written that way.
Yeah.
Anyone can kind of
play
him. And there's a lot of conversation in the acting community and the theater community right now about, you know, access and people, like, I know there's that show on TV, Switched at Birth, which is about, like, there's two children that were switched at birth and one is deaf and one is not. And about, I think they use a real deaf actress in that, which is really great. So just about using different access for people with different abilities and casting directors, just as you talk about, like, non-traditional casting for actors of all ethnicities, talking about it for all abilities.
Sure.
What do you kind of think that directors and casting directors and people in the arts community can do to encourage it?
Well, it's a big, big question with a lot of messy answers. There is a unwillingness to entertain the disability side of that argument that you just articulated with the same kind of embracing that we have, whether it be racially, right? And my suspicion is sometimes that because of the lack of knowledge about what the disability might be, that the producer in some odd, fucked up kind of inverted way might think they're just kind of doing the person a favor by not bringing him in because it was, oh, this is going to be a long shoot in the deserts and how are they going to get, you know, it's like, we'll figure it out, you know. I woefully underestimated what being on television in front of 9 to 12 million people would do. One of my friends who, when she came out as gay, said, I didn't realize that when I came out, I automatically got my activist card. And it seemed like automatically by being kind of catapulted into this primetime television show, now I was expected to be an activist. You know, my personal feelings about how I can change the playing field is by accepting jobs and playing characters where the disability is not central to the story, if ancillary or oblique to the story, that something kind of amazing happens in the mind of a viewer when we watch a disabled actor perform a character and it's not mentioned. You have to make a decision at some point of, am I going to sit here and watch this TV show or film or play and try to figure out what's quote unquote wrong with this person or how it fits into the story, or I'm just going to let it go. And there's a real beauty when you do the let go thing because you accept them as a human being that doesn't need to be contextualized.
Yeah.
And I think we have a need in this country to contextualize otherness in a very simple narrative, you know, that abdicates us of some responsibility. Right?
Yeah.
And so I think, much like blind casting, or I don't know if that term is still even used.
Colorblind casting? Non-traditional casting. Either of which is the nicest way of putting it.
Sure, I know, right. I mean, just how about like...
Casting.
with human beings.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating to me. I know that I've lost jobs because of it. I know that I'm not seen for things, probably because of it. But occasionally you find yourself lucky enough to have an advocate like Willie Know.
Yeah, but what I thought was so beautiful about this, and like you said, there are tons of shows, not tons, but there should be more shows or plays where it's not even acknowledged because the character's not written as anything other than a human,
right.
Or a male or a female.
Right.
So why not cast anyone?
Right, because we have an expectation. We've been trained to expect an answer, right? It's like when people come up to me at a bar or something and they want to break the ice, they say, hey man, what happened to you, right? Let me know the story. And it's like, you're not aware somehow that you're essentially going up to a stranger and saying, hey, tell me about the worst day of your life. You know, and that's for me. Like, there's other things we can talk about. And it's certainly the fact that I had a spinal stroke on St. Patrick's Day, in my mind, is actually one of the least interesting things about me.
Yeah.
It was just a really shitty day.
Sounds
you know?
Awful.
Yeah. So, I think it's just going to kick around until enough otherwise abled artists are out there doing Willie Loman and doing whatever Angels in America or doing these kind of or playing the lawyer on the show or whatever, and it's just not fucking mentioned.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's going to take to have kind of a cultural shift, a perceptual shift of accepting folks as more of the same.
Yeah. I guess the note to end on would be, I know that you had a wonderful, and we're speaking of kind of like life and death and the momentary lapses of our existence, and you had a great relationship with Sheldon Patinkin. And I would love to hear a little bit about kind of your work with him and kind of what he meant to you as a performer.
Well, Sheldon is, he's certainly a scene partner of mine.
Yeah.
In this show. He directed the first show at The Gift. He was an ensemble member of The Gift. He taught us all, not us all, but he taught many of us at the school stuff. And he was someone who, even though he was older and ailing, it seemed inconceivable that he would ever have to pass away. And I think he taught me most. He was a masterclass in kindness and generosity. You know, I don't know how he found the hours in the day to respond to all these emails and Facebook chats and happy birthday on Facebook. And he made time for people. He made time for his family. He made time for his former students, and he chose to stay here. Sheldon could have done anything. Sheldon could have gone, you know, out to LA and New York. He did both cities. Could have been fine there. He decided not to be. And I talk about him a lot on stage. You know, there's a tradition where I come from, something started by the elders is one of the lines that Sheldon. And I'm thinking of the games he taught us at Steppenwolf. And he taught us give and take, you know, which is a theater game of listening and passing off your turn to someone else to move. But it's more a game of cultivating empathy and cultivating sympathy and cultivating how to share. And if you map those things out to the nth degree, you're talking about actually how to live. And he lived by those principles. And I miss him so fucking much.
So we're back. And we can start our recommendations with you, Susie, because you were just in Chicago and you said you saw something there you really liked.
I did. Well, I saw a lot of things there, including Title Indeed, which we just had our wonderful interview with Michael Patrick Thornton. But one of the places I saw that I wasn't initially intending to see, but a friend of mine who lives in Chicago really recommended it, and I was trying to kind of take a theater vacation, but I was like, oh, you know, it's at Steppenwolf, and Steppenwolf is a very great theater company in Chicago. I saw Rory Kinnear's The Herd. Rory Kinnear is a British actor, and this is his first play, and so you kind of go into a show and you're like, first play ever, never written a play, but Lois Smith is in it, and it's a really great, like, family room, living room, whatever you call it, drama, just about a family. It's about this group of family who's gathering for their grandson's birthday party, and the grandson is offstage. He's a mentally disabled person who we never see, but we hear about him, and it's his 21st birthday, and so his mom, whose dad has left, and his sister and her new boyfriend and his grandparents all kind of gather. His grandpa has like a little bit of trouble walking. His grandma, you know, is a sassy grandma. You would think it will be stock characters and like a stock family drama, but it's actually very, very affecting. I mean, Chris Jones gave it 4 stars in the Tribune. It's directed by Frank Galati, who does a lot of work at Steppenwolf. I believe he's an ensemble member there. Great, great set by Walt Spangler. And it's a really, really moving night of theater. If you've ever been in a family or been to a family gathering or know a family, like, you will be moved by it. There's a lot of great parent-child interactions, a lot, both from grandparents to parents and parents to children, and a lot of talk about, you know, disability and that whole theme, which is really interesting. And I don't know.
It's The Herd, spelled H-E-R-D.
Called The Herd, like H-E-R-D.
R-D, like a herd.
Like
of
a
animals.
Herd of people.
Yeah, okay.
It's really just a gorgeous, gorgeous play and production. And there's nothing groundbreaking about it. I mean, it is just a family drama, but I highly recommend it.
Is Rory Kinnear, is he an actor as well?
He's an actor.
Yeah,
he's a British
actor. I know that name from somewhere.
Sounds like Greg Kinnear.
What's that?
Greg Kinnear.
Well, no, I just think I must have seen him in something. It's probably, like, I picture a red-haired guy, but maybe I'm wrong.
I did not meet him because he did not act in his own play.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's really,
well,
really
keep
great.
An eye out for that play.
The woman who stars in it as the mom, I don't even remember what her name is, but I know she's a Steppenwolf Ensemble member. I know she was in August Osage County. Mary someone?
Yeah.
This is awful that I don't remember, but she's wonderful.
You can Google it, and then I'll try it out.
I'm going to Google it. We'll come back to Susie when she knows.
And it probably
might have
been the other sister.
Yeah, probably.
Sister. Yeah, Mary something.
Mary. But it's great. See the Herd.
See the Herd. Or Hear the Herd. No.
Hear the Herd.
Adeep, how about you?
Susie traveled to Chicago this weekend, and I also traveled, which meant we both left Rob by himself in the office.
I got a lot done. Very quiet.
We're very distracting people.
And I went to the Pacific Playwrights Festival, which is the annual new play festival at South Coast Repertory in Costa Mesa, California. And they usually do a 6-play program, but this year was 7. Well, last year was 7 plays. This year, 7 plays. And 2 of those were fully produced world premiere productions. One was Rajiv Joseph's Mr. Wolf, and the other one is Melissa Ross's Of Good Stock. And there's also 4 readings. I am going to recommend one of the readings that I saw, and it's going to get produced at South Coast Rep next season, as well as at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. It's called Viet Gone. It's by a Vietnamese-American playwright, Quy Nguyen. If you lived in New York, then you will know Quy from his work as the founder and artistic director of Vampire Cowboys, and they coined the term geek theater. I talked to Quy, and that interview will be in the next podcast. But the reason that I am talking about this play today is because today that we're recording this, April 30th, is the 40th anniversary of the Fall of Saigon. And it's kind of, Quy and I talked about how it's kind of a turning point for a lot of Vietnamese Americans, insofar as our parents and our families, that's when everything changed, and 1.5 million people just left their homes, and most of them resettled in California. And those people included Quy's parents, who left Vietnam in 1975, and they met at a refugee camp in Arkansas, and the play details how they fell in love. And it's not about war, and it's about the effects of war. And how kind of, it's kind of trying to say, you know, how I guess love can get you through some very tough shit. And the only reason I say that was because the play is also written in like 2015 lingo, so there are no Asian accents, and there are no stereotypes.
Sounds good. Sounds great.
On that note, the actor's name is Molly Regan.
Molly Regan. Okay, yeah.
And she's wonderful.
I'm trying to remember who she played in August Osage County, though.
And her bio said August Osage County.
She might have been in one of the productions. In any case.
She's wonderful in The Herd.
That sounds great. I look forward to that. I like Kui, and his work is... This is a bit of a departure from his Vampire Cowboys material, right?
Yeah, it's...
There's no sword play in this.
There's no sword play. You know, it's very contemporary in lingo, but it tackles some heavy topic, and it's another side to the Vietnam War that's not really talked about.
Right. But yeah, no, I don't, off the top of my head, can't think of depictions of the Vietnamese-American, like, experience, especially post-war. Yeah. Most themes of Vietnam are set there.
Or it's called Miss Saigon. So
there's that
which
one.
Part of that is set here, problems with that musical. But it's not so much... Vietnamese were fighting Americans to reclaim their homeland. There's more gray areas than that. Right.
I just love the fact that it's set in Arkansas. I love talking to Kui about his his mom owned a restaurant there. Is that right? Like a diner?
Oh gosh, I don't know. Kui will explore that in the future.
Yeah. Please do. I'm gonna make this fairly brief. I just wrote a little piece about Second Stage. Acquiring a theater on Broadway, the Helen Hayes Theater, and making them the fourth of New York's nonprofit theaters, off-Broadway theaters, to own acquire a Broadway space on the Commercial Theater District. And I was thinking about the fact that this shows promise that Second Stage will premiere new American plays on Broadway, which is it's a slightly endangered species. There are a lot of seasons the new plays come from Britain or their revivals. In any case, the exception I can think of, Lincoln Center Theater and Roundabout Theater, who also are nonprofits with Broadway houses, they have great new play development programs and new play. You know, they stage a lot of new plays, but they do them off Broadway. They do them in the Roundabout Underground and Laura Pell's
Manhattan Theater Club.
That's what I was about to say. That's that you're building up to that. And Lincoln Center does it at LCC3 and the new house. The off-Broadway spaces, they do a lot of, it's unimpeachable. They do great work off-Broadway. But the Manhattan Theater Club, alone among them, I mean, there are probably some counterexamples. I haven't done the research to see the Roundabout might have premiered a new play. They do new plays on Broadway by living American writers, from David Lindsay Bear, Donald Margulies, David Auburn, and they're off Broadway space as well. They do. I wish they had brought Lynn Nottage's Ruin to Broadway, but they did Lynn Nottage. I think they get lumped together as doing subscription seasons, very safe New York-y plays. But I just the best example I can think of, and then they just did The World of Extreme Happiness. At their off-Broadway space. And then on Broadway right now is Airline Highway. And it's hard to think of a play that's sort of less tailored for the typical Broadway audience. You could say that it's a Steppenwolf play, so it's an ensemble play. It has a sort of Steppenwolf aura about it. But it's a very gritty play. A lot of people are smoking on stage. And I don't know if you've noticed that whenever anyone lights up a cigarette on stage, half the house starts to cough.
The whole house is coughing.
I just.
There's a lot of cigarettes in there.
There's a fair amount of
cigarettes. A lot of alcohol and debauchery.
Yeah. No, it's... I mean, I don't think it's a great, great play. But it's my point is more just I want to give props, a shout-out to Manhattan Theater Club, which I think partly because its name sounds so New York-y and provincial and sort of like they're only going to do plays about white people in the Upper West Side.
They do new plays about white people on the Upper West Side. The Country House, Assembled Parties.
Well, yes, exactly. They do that. Right. What was that one with Sarah Jessica Parker?
That was off-Broadway, but it was by Amanda Peet, a celebrity.
Right. So they do – like it's a fair rap that they produce some stuff that is, in the middle-brow range. But I just think – of the nonprofits on Broadway, I would hope Second Stage follows their model. And again, I don't say anything wrong about what Roundabout does or Lincoln Center. They do great work. It's not just, but they don't put new American plays on their Broadway stages for the most part. And I would love to see more of that. That's my endorsement of the Manhattan Theater Club. Go Lynn Meadow. Keep it
up. Yeah. Oh my gosh,
yes. Female artistic director.
I saw, of Goodstock, I saw PPF. It's going to get a production at Manhattan Theater Club in June. And it's written by female, an up-and-coming female writer. And it's about three sisters.
Who is it?
Is it on Broadway?
Melissa Ross. The Off-Broadway City Center space. And it's about three sisters who do not talk about men. So it more than passes.
Is that like in their tagline? Huh? Three sisters who do not talk about men?
No, but it should be.
I have a question about the Bechdel test. This is, shows my total ignorance. Is it okay if women talk about relationships with women?
Yes.
So it's about, but just about
sexual relationships or friendships?
Yeah, sexual. Like in other words, if women talk about romance in the play or the film, whether it's with whatever gender,
I think
does it pass
considering
the test?
Alison Bechdel's sexuality,
yeah.
I think it's okay if they talk about women. But that is a rarity. How many movies have you seen two women talking about lesbian relationships?
All the time.
For those in the dark, the Bechdel test is created by Alison Bechdel,
right,
author
right.
of Fun Home, basis for Tony Award winning Tony Award nominated musical. And the Bechdel test And the Bechdel test states that if two women in a play, TV show, movie are on screen and they're not talking about a man, it passes the Bechdel test. And it's actually very hard to pass.
And not talking about a man romantically, right?
I think a man, period.
Okay.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, people bitch about their male bosses all the time. Which is also a stigma of women's life being controlled by men.
Hey, we've gone over time, I think. Another great edition of Off Script. Check us out online.